Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Today's guest, New York Times reporter Farnaz Fasihi, reports that Iran is struggling with a fifth wave of the coronavirus pandemic, an economy strained by American sanctions and stalled talks on rescuing a nuclear agreement that was once seen as an economic salvation. Now the country is contending with a different but easily foreseen crisis, a severe water shortage, a prolonged drought and rising temperatures from climate change, combined with decades of government mismanagement of natural resources and lack of planning, have turned the water crisis into a volatile incubator of protests and violent unrests. Farnaz reports that people screaming, "I am thirsty," on the streets of the Khuzestan province in the southwest say they've been met with violence and bullets. Joining us to discuss this is Farnaz Fasihi, an award-winning reporter with The New York Times. Hi, Farnaz. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. I just want to let listeners know that I am getting an echo of myself. So if I sound a little off today, it's because I keep hearing myself, and it's going to be a problem, but I'm just going to try to get through it because apparently we can't fix it back at the station. So I apologize in advance, Farnaz, if I sound a little off, but I'm just hearing an echo.
You
so
sound
first
great,
off,
as always.
The protests have been going on for 8 days now, and it's starting to get some attention in the United States. You wrote about it for the New York Times. I understand that it's 120 degrees Fahrenheit in this province. Is that right?
Right. I mean, Khuzestan is in the southwest province. It's down by the Persian Gulf and bordering with Iraq, and it's the climate is very hot and sometimes humid in the summer. It's also, the air is very polluted because it's where all the oil fields and oil refineries and petrochemical refineries are located. So they're combating with air pollution and shortage of water and extreme heat.
Can you give us some basic facts about this province?
Yes. So Khuzestan is a province where, as I mentioned, about 80% of Iran's oil fields and something like 60% of the gas fields are in Khuzestan. It was really the front line of the eight-year war with Iraq, and part of it was occupied for a time by Iraq during the eight-year war. So Khuzestan really has paid a huge debt to the Islamic Republic because of its significant role in the war. It also has rivers and water reservoirs and lush farmlands that grow crop. They grow wheat, barley. They feed the rest of Iran. There's agriculture, there's farming. And the majority, the other thing about Khuzestan is that it's composed of different ethnicities, the majority of them being ethnic Arabs, and who are mostly farmers and agriculture owners. And they complain, they've complained always that consecutive governments in Iran have discriminated against them, that they have deliberately kept them impoverished. They've taken away their farmlands. And now, as you mentioned, there's drought. There's also, because of climate change, there's drought. But the drought is exacerbated by many, many years of government mismanagement, right? So we can't really, I was talking to some scientists, some climate scientists and water that specialize in water, and they were pointing out that you can't really nail and say one thing is at fault. It's not just climate. It's not just drought. It's that the governments have been depleting and manipulating the natural resources of this province. They've built dams that have redirected water. They have built pipelines, projects that took the water from Khuzestan and through tunnels and underground pipes to central Iran. And now, the reservoirs and the waters are dry, and the people of Khuzestan are, as you pointed out, in the streets shouting, "We want water." We can't. irrigate our farmlands. Our water buffaloes and cattle are dying. This is literally their livelihood.
You report that people are in the streets screaming, "I am thirsty," and they're being met with violence and bullets. Security forces have used tear gas, shrapnel shells, and even live ammunition. And at least 6 people have been killed?
Yes. This is a familiar pattern, right? We know that every time there's a protest in Iran, every time people come out to the streets over the years, the standard or the pattern of the government is to unleash security forces and brutally crush it. And they throw tear gas at them. They disperse them by beating them up. They try to run them over with motorcycle, and they open fire. There are videos on social media that are being posted, crowds running, and they appear unarmed, and they're, you know, protesters, basically poor people who are saying we're fed up with the situation, and they're getting shot and killed. Amnesty International today said that they have confirmation that at least 6 people have been shot, killed. No, 8 people. I'm sorry. Amnesty says that 8 people were shot, killed in the past week. Iran itself says that there are 4 people were killed, 4 protesters were killed, and 1 police officer was killed. So it's getting quite violent, and it's spreading to a few other cities. And as we've seen in the past, you know, one thing like water or gasoline becomes the spark, becomes the trigger that brings people to the streets. But as the protests continue, and as the government crushes them, the grievances and sort of that pent up anger about everything else comes out. So now, for the past couple of days, we've been seeing in videos shared from different cities that people are coming out saying death to the Islamic Republic. We don't want an Islamic Republic. So, you know, it's really tapping into a lot of other issues and anger.
What do you know so far about who is protesting?
Well, we know that the protests started early June, around early July, I'm sorry, by an ethnic Arab sheikh who was a farmer. He's sort of the tribal leader of a group of villages in Khuzestan. And, you know, he was seeing that his farm is drying up, and the men in his tribe were having the same problems. So he gathered them up. They went to the center of the province, to the water and electricity center. And he gave this impassioned speech in a video that was shared with the New York Times about how he thought that this was a deliberate discrimination, that they were implementing policies to drive out the Arabs from their homes and make them migrate. That video went viral, according to activists on the ground, among the ethnic Arab population of Khuzestan, who many of them are ranchers and farmers. And they decided to come out and protest. So first the protests were small, and then they slowly gained momentum and got bigger and bigger. And now it's spread to other cities. It's mostly, you know, working class, laborers, farmers, ranchers. These are the people that we're seeing, and young people.
More than 130 filmmakers issued a statement in support of the protesters. The statement read in part, "Today we stand by the thirsty and oppressed people of Khuzestan. We strongly condemn the repression of these people who seek life and demand that water reach their villages."
It's very hard to make something as basic as the need for water political, right? It's for the government. It's a cause that naturally unifies people. It's something that generates a lot of sympathy, because water is so basic to our survival. So when people are coming out saying we don't have drinking water, we don't have water to you know, wash our clothes, to cook, and we can't afford to buy water to fill up water tanks, our livelihoods are at risk because these patches of land that we'd rely on to grow crop or our cattle, they're literally dying. This is a cause that it can very easily generate sympathy and solidarity. And I think that's what we're seeing. We're even seeing that Iranian officials react to this, because it's hard for them to say, oh, this is typically whenever, particularly in Khuzestan, whenever there are protests, they try to say this is a separatist Arab group, this is the enemies, and use this as an excuse to crush them. But because it's water, what we're hearing from officials is you have a right to protest. Just make sure that the enemies don't abuse them. We are listening to you. We're going to try to resolve it. So it seems that they understand that this is a cause that can very quickly generate even more public support and bring people to the streets. They're trying to contain it.
Today we're joined by Farnaz Fasihi, an award-winning reporter with the New York Times, whose piece you can read. Find it at yourcallradio.org. I Am Thirsty, Water Shortages Compound Iran's Problems. A prolonged drought worsened by climate change and government mismanagement has added a volatile new element to the swirl of challenges in Iran, ranging from the pandemic to U.S. sanctions. If you have any questions for Farnaz about what is happening in Iran, if you've seen this covered in the media and you have any comments, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Farnaz, a water expert, told France 24 that hydraulic dams were built across the country not because they were needed, but because building dams is extremely profitable for builders. This quote, builders mafia has such close ties to the state and the Revolutionary Guards that no one can stop them. Can you comment on that?
One of the things that criticism about the water shortage and the mismanagement, as I mentioned earlier, is this expansion and projects that manipulate water reservoirs and natural resources. And that includes dams, that includes the redirection of water to other provinces. Big projects like this, like dams, and many of them have the involvement of the state one way or another. And we know that the Revolutionary Guards, through an extremely powerful economic conglomerate named Khatam al-Anbiya, have their hands in big projects like this. They're involved in dam making. They're involved in the building of roads, building of really infrastructure. A water expert that I spoke to, who used to be the former deputy head of environment agency in Iran, said that they prioritize creating jobs and making profit over the environment, right? So they go do these projects without really the long-term foresight of how this is going to impact the people living there or the natural resources that we have. He actually explained it as because of these things that Iran is facing water bankruptcy.
Farnaz, can you talk about what is involved in reporting on this and exposing this kind of corruption? Like, who's behind the building? Who's making the money? Who's got close ties to the state and the Revolutionary Guards? What is involved in exposing that information?
Well, I mean, it takes, like any good reporting, it takes, diligent sort of digging and having sources that could, reliable sources that could connect you to that. It's hard to do it because the Revolutionary Guards are extremely secretive, and they have a lot of front companies, right? It's not always obvious that this is the Revolutionary Guards. These conglomerates have a lot of branches, a lot of front companies that operate for them, and they might appear like they're the private sector, but they're actually connected to them. So it's a difficult task in terms of trying to find out. We you know, like all investigative projects, we try to dig through and see what we find through local sources on the ground. For the protest story, you know, we try not to completely, as the New York Times, we try not to completely just rely on social media videos and social media posts. I actually had to stay up really late two nights in a row so I could, because of the time difference with Iran, so I could actually find people in Ahvaz. I could, in Khuzestan, I could talk to protesters and activists who were helping organize. And some of the, I spoke to a street vendor who'd been out protesting. And he was telling me that, you know, I don't have water at home. We have to go to relatives' homes to shower or bring water. If I make enough money, as a street vendor, I can maybe buy water that lasts my family a few days for just drinking and cooking. So people are really feeling, and it's really, as you mentioned earlier, it's really hot. So people are really frustrated. So I try as much as I can through sources and activists to get connected to people on the ground, because, you know, ideally it would be great if we could be on the ground, but in the absence of that, it's good to at least talk to people who are actually there rather than just rely on social media.
What else did you hear from the people you were able to connect with?
I heard that the protests are very violent, that they are, that people are coming out and they're, as you mentioned, being met with bullets, that they're afraid to take the injured to the hospitals because the intelligence agents are present in emergency rooms and they will arrest them. They take the people who are wounded. I heard that the farmers have been threatened, that they come to their farms and close the electrical pumps they have in order to control the water shortage. So there's a lot of fear and frustration.
And Farnaz, can you remind us, are you able to go to Iran to do this kind of reporting there?
I wish I could, Rose. I haven't been to Iran in a few years because of the threats that dual national journalists face. We know there are currently four Iranian Americans in jail in Iran on murky charges of spying. Jason Rezaian, my friend and colleague for the Washington Post, was jailed in Iran. So they target dual nationals, and it's very risky. So I don't feel safe going back and reporting there. I wish I could.
Wow. What about just other reporters in Iran? Can you just give us a sense of what the media landscape is like there now?
In terms of local media or foreign media?
Let's say both. First, foreign.
Well, foreign, they're, because of these kind of threats, increasingly they've made it difficult for foreign media organizations to have full-time staff on the ground. I think Associated Press and Agence France-Presse, the AFP, have bureaus in Iran. Reuters does not, and the Times doesn't have a full-time person there. The Post doesn't have a full-time person there. I think that some media organizations have local stringers that they rely on, like freelancers. Occasionally, as in the presidential election in June, they give visas for a week. My colleague went there for the presidential election. So they give limited visas, and it's very controlled. You go, you have to cover the event that you're given a visa to. You're not really allowed to travel outside of Tehran, and then you leave. So very controlled. Local media is under a lot of pressure, but they do good reporting. I mean, there's really no independent media in the way that we know it in the West. Most of the newspapers and news agencies are either connected to the government, connected to the Revolutionary Guards, or connected to a particular political faction. They really represent the view of, say, the Reformist Party or the centrist or the government or the hardliners. You can really, in a much more defined way that we have here, they're actually the voice of that movement, right? So in order to really get a broad sense of what the big picture is in Iran, I have to read multiple newspapers, and I've got to sort of monitor different outlets to get a big picture. You can't really rely on one to get a sense of that. And I think covering Iran from outside, it would be, I think it's, I've managed to do it because I've spent a lot of time on the ground in Iran over the past 25 years. So I have a lot of sources and I read, I speak Farsi fluently. I can read and write Farsi. So I can manage to sort of monitor social media and the media in Iran. Otherwise, it's very hard to cover a place from afar.
Farnaz, it seems like these, as you said, these protests are only going to grow because, as you report in the New York Times, the energy minister warned in May that Iran was facing the driest summer in 50 years. Temperatures approaching 122 degrees would lead to cuts in electricity power and shortages. And as we know, we've had you on many times just talking about what people are facing, the COVID pandemic, financial insecurity. They are so, especially the young people are so tired of these regimes. So can you give us a sense of what you expect based on the conversations you've had with these young people?
Well, I think that you touched on a good point. There are many reasons that make Iran a powder keg, that any spark can really make people come to the streets and explode and vent out their anger and frustration at the government. But on the other hand, the government has very successfully crushed them, crushed these protests in extremely brutal ways. Last November, they were shooting at people point blank in the head and in the neck when we had nationwide protests. Human rights organizations say at least 300 people died, 7,000 were arrested. They ban young students from working, from traveling, from going back to the university. So they make the price of dissent and protesting so costly and so devastating that people come out and then it gets quiet and then it comes. So we've seen this pattern where there's something that sparks the protest, people come out and then they get crushed. It gets quiet for a while until the next crisis. You know, people are not coming out in other cities in huge numbers because they're afraid, right? Like even now, if people thought that, I think if Iranians thought that they weren't going to be met by bullets, that they weren't going to get arrested, we would see much larger protests, peaceful protests in Iran supporting Khuzestan.
Right. And what's incredible is the people going out to protest know that they could be shot and killed.
They say we have nothing to lose. You know, I mean, this is one of the things that a couple of the protesters in Khuzestan told me, that that they are really that life is so difficult for them that they have nothing to lose. And they're willing to take that risk and go outside and be hurt.
We're speaking today with Farnaz Fasihi, a reporter with The New York Times, who's got a piece about what is happening in the Southwest with massive water shortages. It's so incredibly hot. People do not have access to water, and people are going out onto the streets and risking their lives. Farnaz, before we let you go, can you give us any updates on internet access? Has the internet been slowed down and or disconnected in some areas?
The internet's been disrupted from day one in the protest. This is one of the other typical things that the Iranian government does whenever there's a protest someplace. They cut down, they slow down or cut internet, disrupt it, and they cut out cell phone service. So we've been hearing that locally in these towns and cities or neighborhoods where are flashpoints of protests in the past week, internet disruptions, cell phone receptions being cut off. And this is because they want to first prevent people from sharing videos and sharing live reports of what's happening there. And second, they want to prevent them from organizing because people use phone applications like WhatsApp or Telegram or Instagram to mobilize and organize and let one another know what's happening. And they really want to try to block that. And that's also true for cell phones.
And just briefly, Iran, like so many other countries, are dealing with a yet even more coronavirus infections. The AP reports that on Tuesday, Iran broke another record in the country's daily new cases. Sadly, 250 people died on Monday. And then Tuesday, Iran embarked on yet another lockdown, the nation's fifth so far, that is meant to last until next Monday. Bazaars, marketplaces, public offices, all closed.
Iran's been stumbling from one wave of the pandemic to the next. Really, the management of COVID and vaccine has been chaotic. They can't really, they say we can't really shut down. They never really shut down. These shutdowns have been periodically because our economy can't sustain it. They've had the vaccine management has not been satisfactory. There, I think something like only 4 or 5% of the population are vaccinated right now. So there's been a lot of chaos, and the numbers keep going up.
And Farnaz, we have a quick question from a listener. Who is helping Iran build its surveillance system?
Iran, I've reported in the past that that Iran has purchased from China, from a company named Huawei, that they buy the surveillance technology that has dual use, right? So that you can say that we want this. Iran says we want this because we have to crack down on drug smuggling from Afghanistan. We need to control the drug lords and criminals. But that these technologies also have a dual use, that they can be used to monitor and track dissidents, right? They can use the software. I mean, we're seeing now with this big Pegasus story from the Israeli software that was used, that a consortium of media organization have investigated and are putting out the news. So this has been Iran's been purchasing technology that could have that kind of a use in order to control and monitor its dissidents.
Farnaz Fasihi is an award-winning reporter with the New York Times. You can find her latest piece at yourcallradio.org. Farnaz, thank you so much for your reporting, and thank you for joining us again.
Thank you very much, Rose. I appreciate it. It's always good to talk to you.
You too. Thank you so much. Have a nice weekend.
You
and
too. Bye-bye.
We are going to talk about that Pegasus system next Friday. We are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will discuss another incredible documentary from Frontline called The Power of the Fed. It asks, as the Federal Reserve pumps billions of dollars into the financial system, who is benefiting and at what cost? This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.